Premium Hoops presents Sense and Scalability.
Sense and Scalability. Oh my goodness, is it great to be back? That was fun. Oh my gosh, it's all coming back to me now. How are you doing, Evan?
Doing great, Scott. I don't know how much you'll edit this, but I appreciate that the amount of time you took to finish Sense and Scalability was about proportional to the amount of time it took us to get back on the podcast and actually record. How are you doing?
Yeah, it's been a minute. I am elated to be on the mic with my pals. That also being Cody. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm so excited to be recording this podcast. I'm also just super amped right now. I'm living in my high school self at the moment because the Matrix 4 teaser trailer just dropped and Iron Maiden came out with a new album like 6 days ago. So 16-year-old Cody is just as happy as 28-year-old Cody is, and I'm living the best off-season life right now.
All that could add to that would be an Elder Scrolls 6 trailer.
Stop. I don't have the time. I don't have the time.
Why would that happen when they could just re-release Skyrim for the 30th time?
That's a good joke, because they definitely do that. I'm more of an Oblivion guy anyway. And Cody, how is that playthrough going for Oblivion?
I honestly have just spent most of the time power leveling as much as possible. Like, sometimes I jumped in and actually did quests, but like my efficiency brain is like, no, you must be leveling up +5 or +4 for each skill every single time, or else this playthrough is just nullified. So I'm quite the sorcerer at the moment. You'd be very proud of me, I think.
So sorcerer, you've kind of focused on intelligence.
Yeah, intelligence and willpower, and then endurance, because I want to be a tank.
That's right.
So character's really good at blocking, so I can just take a lot of hits and then just wielding all of the magic ever. It's wonderful.
We really have to do an Oblivion pod at some point. This offseason. We have like 1 month left before basketball starts. This won't be the Elder Scrolls Oblivion pod, as much as I want to keep peppering Cody with questions about his character. We're going to do the mailbag pod, Sense and Mailability, part 3. Always one of our favorites. We got a lot of great questions once again. Part of what makes this work is that we've kind of, I don't want to say cultivated, since I don't know if we specifically meant to do this, but a lot of smart people listen to our podcast. Like, I just really felt like, I don't know, maybe it's because we say proprioception a lot, but whatever we do attracted a lot of smart people, and we're really thankful for you, and we're thankful for these questions, of which we have many good ones. So first question is from @BryceHendrick14, and he said, can I ask two? So yes, but that was actually another question. So really he asked three, but you can also ask three, Bryce. So that's okay. Do you worry at all about the Bulls roster construction hurting the development of Patrick Williams? If so, where, oh my God, this is four questions. If so, where would you most like to see him develop, irregardless of logical trades? Also, can we get the Evan Zoucha and Cody Hodick hair care routines? So we'll get to the hair routines in a second. But one thing that I thought of when hearing this question was, you know, what is like developmental context, and what role does it exactly have in assuring a player is good? You know, I think there's a podcast that Evan did with Sean Darenthal on the Stepien feed where, you know, it was kind of a little bit of an argument, more of a spirited debate actually, about, you know, Evan and I on our podcast with Henry for the draft, we're talking about like the importance of developmental context. And Sean offered a, you know, differing viewpoint of like, are we so sure that there's like this strong correlation between like positive development context and, you know, players being good. Some players are just like, just figure it out. And who's to say why players go from being bad to good? And yeah, that kind of leaves my head spinning when we talk about, like, you know, what the developmental context means, whether it's good or bad for Patrick Williams. Like, I don't know how much bearing that has on his outcome as a player. But that being said, we can still weigh in on his developmental context. And I think Evan would be the best person to start, since you've probably thought about the Bulls the most here.
Yeah. So this is a really good question. And to kind of couch my thoughts that I said on the podcast with Sean, the way I think of this is that not all flowers can bloom through concrete, but some can. And the concrete will potentially alter the ways, the directions in which the flower blooms, depending on where the light comes from. So in the case of Patrick Williams, I don't worry too much about the roster construction hurting his development. I think development is benefited by playing on good teams, and the Bulls are going to be the best they've been in the last 4 years, I think. They had a really fun offseason, and from a philosophical perspective, they built a roster that I think is going to be very interesting and very modern. What this does mean is that I don't think Patrick Williams is going to have a lot of on-ball opportunity this year. Now, that it remains to be seen how Billy Donovan staggers Zach LaVine and DeMar DeRozan, for one. And if they stagger a lot, there may be opportunities for Pat to do some secondary creation and stuff like that. And I think he'll get some opportunities running a little bit of pick and roll this year, or at least I hope he does. Summer League gave me the inclination that he might. So I'm not that worried about the roster construction and the way it's built hurting his development, but I do think that any on-ball creation opportunities are going to be a bit delayed or diminished. And what that means is that perhaps he develops in a direction that is more akin to, you know, an opportunistic offensive player who scores off cuts and scores off catch and shoot, who can run a little bit of secondary or tertiary stuff. But I think what the roster context will really help him develop is his defensive skills, especially the weak side rim protection and some switchability as well, because this roster is, I think, going to be pretty switchable, and he's going to be a pretty key cog in that machine. So we'll see what directions the sun comes from and where he grows towards that sun in response. But I'm more than anything just really interested in this Bulls team, not super worried about anything.
I was thinking about it from the defensive end too, because this is going to be an interesting context where he might not be tasked with doing everything defensively this year. Like, there could theoretically be a lineup where it's him, Caruso is out there, Lonzo is out there, and all of a sudden you have three pretty high-level defensive players. And I'm interested to know how taking a step back with your role offensively while also being buoyed around some really good defenders helps your development, I guess. Like, when you're put into that kind of constraint, is I think seeing these different elements, like, oh, this year I can do a lot more on defense because I can count on my teammates, is going to just help him visualize the game in a different way. So in that way, I agree with you. I like the defensive side of it. I find that more interesting for him this coming year.
And even offensively, it's not like, I mean, PD is the kind of champions this a lot, and he talks about, like, kind of starting, you know, a wing in the Kawhi mold, where it's like, you know, you have first couple of years mostly catch and shoot, a few closeout attacks, and they can kind of learn the game at a pace where it's not overwhelming to them, learn angles in a way where they're not like making like five mistakes a quarter in the pick and roll, and like they're learning too many things and they know what to like do with or like take as lessons. And so I almost think that this allows him to like process NBA speed at his own pace, because he doesn't have to do any more creation than he wants to.
Yeah. And just on the kind of topic of the defense, we talk all the time about, you know, shells that break in unpredictable ways being a tough context to develop in, because you don't know where the leak is going to spring up, only that you're pretty sure it's going to. I think the leaks are going to be a little bit easier to predict this year, and therefore probably easier to cover for. And that's going to make Pat's job especially much easier. And I think it'll allow him opportunities to you know, since those base levels of the hierarchy of defensive needs have been fulfilled, he can reach for those upper levels, the nice to haves, the parking lot items. So it'll be interesting to see what his defensive role is, you know, especially depending on how they put the starting lineup together. And I mean, I think Pat's going to start. I hope he's going to start. I think it makes the most sense. But the context is going to be interesting. And I think it will somewhat guide how he develops, but I'm still pretty in on Pat as a prospect in general, and I don't think this context hurts that perspective at all.
And that kind of leads us into the second part of that question, where it's like, where would you most like to see him develop? There, I don't really have a place that's like markedly better than Chicago for me. All the things we're talking about, like, would it be cool if he? If you just gave him the ball in the Thunder and he ran a bunch of pick and rolls, sure, that would be kind of cool. But I don't know if that's the way I would kind of ease him into creation responsibility. I think there are pros and cons to each way, to the point where there isn't like a for sure better place for him in my eyes.
The one nomination I might make, and I think I mostly agree with you, is perhaps it'd be really fun to watch him develop in the Raptors context. And everyone would think the Raptors just because they're like the G League developers, quote unquote. But they're building a lineup of guys that are all wing sized and can do a little bit of creation. And so I don't think he'd have to do like a ton with ball in hand, but he'd have the opportunity to split that responsibility among a lot of kind of like sized players. Plus that defense would just be really fun to watch. So if anything, if I had to pick another team besides Chicago to watch Pat develop, I think that would be fun. But I think Chicago is a pretty good context for his development still.
Didn't know Henry was on for the second podcast in a row. No, but that would be great to just have all the like Scotty Barnes, Pat Williams, OG, and Siakam. You know, that is Henry Ball at its finest. Let's get to the second part of the question, or rather the fourth part, depending on how you look at it. I'm going to start with my hair care routine that nobody wants. We'll start from least important to most important. And what I do is I use this gel called American Crew. It's got high fiber, low shine. I don't like my hair to be shiny, but I like, you know, to have a little bit like a little bit of a, you know,
hold
exactly. A little bit to the, I fade it a little bit to the right, because, you know, my hairline is, I have this kind of line going through the left side of my head. So I make it style it to the right. And it's got a picture of Elvis on the cover, which I don't love. I think Elvis is kind of messed up. But, you know, I can't really control that my favorite hair gel has a picture of Elvis on it.
I don't know how either of us can top that.
That was incredible content. That was apex.
We don't know how to feel about Elvis here on the podcast.
I think the more you learn about Elvis, the less you like him.
So that's all right, everybody. You can pack it up. The podcast is done. We've got Elvis takes in. We answered a basketball question. No, I guess I can give my hair care routine next. By the way, American Crew fiber, very good. That's what I used to use when I have short hair, or when I had short hair. It's good
stuff.
Wow.
So that makes me feel good, because people ask for your hair care routine. And if people are asking, that means regardless of whether you have long or short hair, you have a good one, in my opinion. You know, I'm kind of the belief that scales to longer hair.
So that
kind of validates my decision.
Well, glad to help. My hair care routine is extremely complicated nowadays. I just changed it. I use Function of Beauty, which is like customizable shampoo and conditioner. Those are both great. I use a Tresemme anti-heat spray. I use a mousse, and then like a salt spray, I think. Basically, all of these things are designed to add volume. Oh, also, in terms of how often I wash my hair 3 times a week at most, 2 to 3 times a week. And I condition every day, and that's my routine. And I blow dry it with like a curling blow dryer. It's like a combo blow dryer brush, that I just got at Target, and it's pretty neat.
So, you know, we got through everything that Scott said, and then when you started saying my hair care routine is, it hit me the absurdity of this whole segment right now. So I'm loving this at the moment. This is exactly what I imagined how we'd get back together after a month hiatus. But I'm not going to use Aveeno's name until they sponsor me. So until then, I won't say
Aveeno. Yeah, Scott, beep that out.
Yeah, definitely beep out the fact that I'm saying Aveeno because I'm not using their name. But if I were to be using their name, I would be using their oatmeal milk blend shampoo. And I shampoo every single day. I have no reason to not do it. It works for me. I also don't use conditioner. I feel like it makes my hair a little too slick, and I have some very oily skin. Very oily hair. I also have some pretty thin hair. I'm probably going to go bald by my mid-30s, so I'm living it up with the man bun right now. Then when I'm tying in the man bun, I need to go through like four times. I don't know what you call it, but like I have to run it through four times before I get the tight little man bun back there. Yeah. That's about it. Oh, when I go out in public, I usually need to use hair gel or else it kind of frizzes up all over the place. I won't use the brand because I'm not wedded to that, but I'm not using any brand, especially Aveeno's. So that's my hair care routine.
Cody, I'd like to introduce you to a little magical item called dry shampoo. It is like a spray can of like, God, I don't even really know what it's made out of, but it essentially just soaks up oil, adds volume, and like doesn't leave your hair. Like you don't have to get in the shower. It's amazing. It is probably the best thing I learned about hair by having long hair. My girlfriend introduced me to it. Life-changing.
Pro tip taken. Thank you so much. I will definitely try that out and report back some other podcast.
And that's hair care on Sense and Scalability.
I forgot to say my shampoo.
Oh, good call.
I use Pert.
I have no idea what that is.
Pert? I don't either.
P-E-R-T? You guys don't have Pert?
Unfamiliar.
No. What? It comes in the green bottle? Do I need to bring it? Do I need to go to my shower and show you the bottle right now?
No, you really don't.
I've had Pert shampoo. It's been in my house my entire life.
So you are wedded to it. I googled Pert, and what I got is a business process analysis chart, flow chart. Very...
Does this shampoo exist outside of my house?
Apparently not.
Where was my mom getting this? Let's go to the next question. This is from at Gabe Left Brain. What young players, parentheses, say 2018 draft onwards, parentheses, have the potential to make the jump to all-star plus level play this year? I mean, who doesn't, you know? Like, everyone has the potential. Everyone has potential.
To give a real answer, I was going to say, I think if I were to be a betting man, the player I would really go to the bank with on this is Colin Sexton. I don't want to say I'm high on the Cavaliers this coming year, but I do think they're going to do a little bit better. And since he's going to be the leading scorer for the team, people who vote for the All-Stars like people who score a lot of points. And I think he's going to be rewarded for that this coming year. And the Eastern Conference usually just has a dearth of strong guard play. So I wouldn't be surprised to see him sneak in. But to give a maybe more dark horse pick here, I really like Chuma Okeke. I don't think he has the counting stats to actually make it there, but I really like what I see him doing out there. Maybe he's a little too defensive focused to make it to the All-Star team. But those are my two picks right now. There's a lot of good players. I think especially the 18 draft, I'm looking through it and I'm like, I think there's a lot of really good looking guys here, but I'm going to stick with those two guys for right now.
Good looking and good players. Evan, do you have any?
Yeah, I think if I had to pick two, I generally think it's more difficult to make the All-Star game at the guard spots for both conferences. But I do like the Sexton pick, Cody. That's good reasoning as well. My two picks would be probably DeAndre Ayton and DeAndre Hunter. This is the DeAndre hype pod. Ayton was really, really, really good last year and honestly was nearing All-Star caliber levels of play at his hottest stretches. The Suns are going to be coming back with basically everybody. So the consistency in both role and context will be there in a way that I think will help kind of make some of the earlier growing pains from last season not happen this year. DeAndre Hunter is kind of my dark horse candidate. He was injured a lot of last season, but when he played, he was really, really good. He's a staunch defender who can do stuff on and off ball. And the offensive game has really come along as well. He was running some pick and roll, still a very good shooter. So That's a pretty alluring skill set in a kind of combo for forward size body, and the Hawks are going to be good again this year, I think. So I think it's going to be tough for either of those guys to shine enough on their respective rosters to earn All-Star consideration. But if I had to pick two guys who would be nearing that level who aren't already at that level, those would be my two bets.
I'd go Luka Doncic and Zion Williamson. I think both have a chance to be All-Star caliber.
Just a chance.
I'll go with another Cavs guard. I really liked what I saw from Darius Garland last year. He kind of showed me enough passing to where I'm not like, okay, you know, there you could run 50 pick and rolls to this guy and field a pretty good offense. And then this might not be like a dark horse one, but like, I just really like Anthony Edwards. And when you think about how often they're going to have him go to the rim this year, and just how much they put the ball in his hands down the stretch last year, and how Finch will just get so good at getting him downhill. I'm very excited to watch Anthony Edwards next year. Okay. This one is from at NBA Circles. And it says, realistically, how good can a modern NBA offense be without a single good on-ball advantage creator? What helps is that the 2015 Hawks serve as a reference point for this, but there's probably a more nuanced answer as well.
That Hawks team also really was helped out by the magic of regular season Budenholzer, who, I don't know, he can just take players like that isn't necessarily a strong primary creator and make a strong offense out of them. So I think it's like looking at the early 2000s Spurs with Popovich, and it's like, how good are they actually with a league average type of coach? But what I was looking at is last season, here are some teams that had a negative relative offensive rating. The Memphis Grizzlies, the Toronto Raptors, the Miami Heat, the Golden State Warriors, the Chicago Bulls. So some of those teams, I think, I didn't put them down, but I think the Wizards also would have made that list. So you have guys like Bradley Beal, Russell Westbrook, Stephen Curry on teams that actually had worse than league average offenses, and all of them should be considered like very, very good primary creators. So I'm kind of putting my hands up in the air saying, I'm really not sure. I also don't know what you mean by the word good. Like, are we talking like Corey Joseph? Because he's not a good primary creator. But are we talking like more league average, like Nikola Vucevic? How good is a Nikola Vucevic-led offense? So really, I'm not sure. I would say that if we were going like all-time best non-primary creator offensive players I could pick from, I could probably make a good offense, a la the Budenholzer Hawks. But in an actual realistic league, I think we're looking at a team that's -1, -2, -3 relative offensive rating.
I don't think he was considering Corey Joseph a good on-ball advantage creator, but I could be wrong.
The way I perceive a good on-ball advantage creator in this question is like a straw that can stir the drink, a guy who can break the shell enough off dribble, probably with burst or something like that, to create advantages that others can pick apart, or that he can pick apart for others. My short answer to this question is probably not very good. My long answer to this question is kind of fake good. Like, you'd be probably successful in a regular season when teams aren't really scheming for the stuff you have to do on and off ball schematically to create advantages, where otherwise you could just like the kinds of difficult advantages you'd have to create if you didn't have a guy who's just going to create easy, like very obvious ones off dribble. And Budenholzer's Hawks are kind of a good example of that, because they were really, really good in the regular season. But once teams had the capability to kind of scheme for them in a 7-game series, those kind of hard work buckets that you get from creative scheming dissipate some, for sure. So we've kind of talked in the past about how primary creation becomes even more important in the playoffs, especially the teams with multiple primary creators nowadays. So I think a team with no real solid to very good on-ball advantage creator would really struggle in a playoff context, even if they do okay in the regular season.
Yeah, you oftentimes do need a straw that stirs the drink, whether it's one of those straws with like the chocolate coating, or like one of those Slurpee straws at 7-Eleven that have a spoon at the end, or even just a normal straw. It's good to just have a straw, and that is more and more the case every year, it feels like, as offenses become more turbocharged. This one is from at Garrett Bouguet. Why is Scott's nickname Socks? Why don't you guys refer to him as socks? Favorite type of sock? Favorite color of sock? Your take on Bo Burnham's puppet song, How the World Works? What can the NBA and its players do to better promote their socks? Socks? So yeah, I decided at my socks was my nickname at my former job, selling running shoes. I just kind of was like, and it started where I wanted to give myself for Ultimate Frisbee in college the nickname Socks for our like personalized jerseys. Cause one day I was just like, Socks is, would be a funny nickname. And this is before I knew that, you know, in NBA circles, there was Elliot Socks Perry's, who I think he played for the Grizzlies. Fact check me on that. Anyway, what was I going to say? Yeah, Socks. When I got to Fleet Feet, I was like, yeah, call me Socks. You know, I was like, how Paul Reed, AKA B-Ball Paul, on the first day of Sixers training camp said, call me Allie. You know, that kind of vibe. And, yeah, so my favorite type of sock would have to be a, you know, working and run specialty. I definitely have a few choices, but I would have to go with a Balega Hidden Comfort. It's a little thicker than other Balega socks. It's no show, but it's got the little tab at the end so that it doesn't like roll down your foot. And there you just slip on them and it's just wonderful. You feel like you're not wearing socks. And it's a great running sock. In fact, that's what it's designed for. But, you know, I have so many that I just kind of wear them for fun as well. My take on Bo Burnham's sock puppet song, How the World Works. I actually had an interesting conversation with my friend about Bo Burnham a couple days ago, because I was like, I kind of don't like anything he's done in the last 10 years. And I liked his like, you know, old like lo-fi YouTube covers of just like, you know, inappropriate stuff. And now it seems like so much of his shtick is based on like, where does he go from there? And that's an understandable question, but he like tries to make that his shtick, or he's like, he wants you to like look at back behind the curtain and see like his writer's block, or like how he, you know, that goofy guy isn't totally him. And I just, as much as I enjoyed him growing up, I just don't really care about his grappling with his identity as a performer and as a person. It doesn't interest me to go along that adventure with him. And I understand there was a lot of that in his new special, Inside. And my friend's like, yeah, give it a chance. It's like, you know, really smart like that. And I'm just like, if that's what it's going to be like, I am not that interested. I'd rather just hear him make funny songs about, and puns about math from like 2008. So I don't quite know where I'm at with Bo Burnham. So I haven't seen that, but what can the NBA and its players do to better promote their socks? Sorry, I'm just tackling all these because I thought of really good answers for all of them. I think the NBA's collective sock game has gone downhill since Deron Lamb left the league. Now, if you don't follow Deron Lamb on Twitter, he does provide a good amount of inspiration. And like, I'm not one for motivational quotes, but he actually, you know, the ones he just tweets, the sentences he tweets are actually like pretty good advice. I'll be quite honest. It seems like he's really knows a lot about himself, and that's cool to see. But he had some socks that had dreidels on them. They were blue and they had dreidels on them. And he tweeted them and he says, sock of the day. And I retweeted it because, you know, I just didn't expect him to have that appreciation for Jewish culture. And I appreciated Deron Lamb for wearing those socks. That's my answers to all those questions.
So it makes sense that socks would answer all the socks questions, which is good because I don't actually have takes on any of these.
Yeah, I'm glad you actually answered those. I wasn't really sure what I was going to say about any of them. Besides, I can answer. Why don't we call you Sock Scott?
Well, this is
the first time I'm hearing of it, so that's why I don't call you that.
That's true.
Do you guys have any thoughts on Bo Burnham? Agree, disagree with what I said?
I'm like exactly where you're at. I remember Bo Burnham from when I was young. He was kind of fun. I enjoyed his stuff a little bit here and there, like in passing. I have been recommended to watch the special. I'm sure it's good if you're into that sort of thing. There are so many entertainment options and so little time to enjoy those entertainment options that my to-do list of like entertainment and media to consume is so long already that maybe I get to it eventually. Who knows? But probably not.
He had this like video that wasn't even a song. It was just called A Day in the Life. And it was just like him being a loser by himself in his house. And like he tried to dunk on a 6-foot hoop and kept missing. And that was so funny.
Oh, man. 6 feet, huh? Oh, jeez.
For that specific video, a friend had me watch it and I laughed and I thought it was clever. And then I never thought about it again until I saw this question. So that's how I think about it.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, he seems talented. I actually saw him live in 2015 and it was pretty good. But then I kind of realized the road he was going down in terms of like trying to be more serious at times. And I wasn't for it. We keep it light here at Sense and Scalability. As you notice, Bo Burnham has not been a guest on Sense and Scalability. So you tell me what that means. This one is from N. Schindler NBA. Hi, Mark. I like Mark. How do you guys feel about Mark?
Good guy. Love Mark.
Yeah. I think he would make my top three Marks that I know in my life.
Nice. Does that include Mark people as well as like, you know, Marks like birthmarks or stretch marks? Wow.
You actually interrogated me. That was the end of my punchline. I wasn't prepared for a rebuttal, but I like that. You've bested me this time.
Mark is the number one Mark in all of the Marks.
Wow.
You heard it. Like
high marks.
What about the dark mark from Harry Potter? That's a pretty cool mark. No, that's the worst mark because we're an anti-Voldemort podcast.
Yeah, this is an anti-he who shall not be named podcast. Mark had a question about basketball, didn't he?
So Mark Schindler's question was, power rank your three favorite contenders who could actually make a trade for Thad Young, who would most positively benefit from his addition.
Okay. Clippers, trade Ibaka because he's washed. Sorry, I love Serge. And when Justice Winslow becomes tradable, trade him too. That lines up with Thad's salary. You already commit to small ball. Thad is the perfect small ball five for that team. Not quite the shooter that Marcus Morris is, but better at everything else. Really good defender, obviously. Great passer, which, you know, their offense kind of relies on those quick passing reads. I would love to see Thad on the Clippers. There's other teams too, but that was the one where I could make an actual trade scenario.
Yeah, I think if you think that a team would give up a first for Thad Young, which I think that the right team, aka like a contender, that's their pick is going to be in the late 20s to 30 anyway. I think there are actually a decent number of teams that can afford and would greatly benefit from Thad Young. But the other two that I would add to the Clippers, I think the Clippers are a great fit, are the Phoenix Suns, who have actually been rumored to be interested in Thad. And I think that he would fill the Dario Saric backup small ball five role really nicely. Or Brooklyn. And I don't know if that's actually reasonably attainable now. Brooklyn's roster is pretty complete. But I think he would have been a great fit there as a mix-in small ball five option.
I guess the Spurs might want more than those players. So, yeah, you could throw in a pick maybe if Clippers are so behooved. Maybe throw in like a BJ Boston or a Keon Johnson. Wouldn't that be funny to have Keon Johnson as the Spurs? Like all of their guards are Keon Johnson.
It's a good position to be in, really.
Yeah. Just different types of Keon. Like Derek White is just Keon Johnson that learned how to shoot. DeJounte Murray is just Keon Johnson who got better at defense.
I have no arguments.
Yeah, exactly. I'm smart. Cody, did you think of any?
Yeah, I did. I was playing around with the trade machine. And I sent a message to you too. Like, I can't figure out how to make any of these trades work. So sorry, Mark. I don't know if this is actually possible, but the number one team for me is I would love to see him on the Mavericks. And I would like for him to get there without the Mavericks giving up Porzingis, because I really like the idea of Luka, Thad, and Porzingis being on the court together, because you get some more secondary creation. Porzingis is going to be spacing the floor, so Thad has a little bit more room to operate with his passing. Defensively, I think if Porzingis, and I don't want to step on a question that's coming up later, but defensively, if those two are rolling at the top of their game, that could be a really strong defensive tandem. So I think that could be a move that ultimately gets the Mavericks closer to contender status. I don't know how they'd get the trade to work, but I would like to see that.
Cody, if both guys are rolling, then nobody's spacing, and the spacing in the half court is going to be terrible. No, I'm just kidding. That's a terrible joke.
Oh my gosh. I thought about Mavericks. One thing that makes me feel okay about them if they don't trade Thad is I'm a Maxi Kleber truther. You know, that's kind of a popular nerd opinion to have, but I'm a nerd, so I have that opinion. I thought there are times where I'm like, wow, Maxi's their second best player last year. So yeah, but Thad would provide a little bit more passing, and hey, it's good to have both, because then you always have that like ancillary rim protection on the court next to Porzingis, which he probably needs at this point, for better or worse. So yeah, that gets us to us next question from at the role player one, spelled R-O-L-L. What can a fully healthy offseason do for KP and the Mavs? Yeah, I guess the question first off is like, if what do you guys think he is if he's not hurt or, you know, injured or whatever he is all the time?
So a couple, I don't even remember how many seasons now. It was at the heart of the beginning of the pandemic, but I wrote an article early on in Premium Hoops asking whether or not Kristaps Porzingis should be considered for Defensive Player of the Year. And, you know, I don't think the answer is yes, but I think that it's an interesting enough question because consistently starting with his Knicks days, his impact numbers for defense, and I'm talking like on off, whenever he missed games, sorts of things were really incredible. And his rim protection numbers rivaled pretty much that of anyone. I think he has some mobility issues guarding out on the perimeter, and I don't think he's particularly switchable in those sorts of cases. But as a like apex rim protector and a 3-point spacer, I think, I don't know, that's a pretty good player. I don't know how high level of a player that is, and I don't think he's very shiftable in the fact that you could move him up and have him run the offense with Luka on the bench for a period of time. But that's a really good second, third option on a team, especially as a first option on defense. So really good. Maybe all-star level impact. I don't know if he gets up to all-NBA level impact, but I don't know. What do you two think?
I am quite a bit lower on KP myself, although I will say that this is a good question because I do think this kind of second season after his injury or the first full season of health is going to be a pretty big game changer for Kristaps Porzingis. That's an injury that generally takes like, gosh, I don't want to put a number on it because I don't want to quote what I read incorrectly or something like that, but it definitely takes longer than... It takes longer to fully heal than it takes to get back on the court. And you could tell that KP's mobility was kind of hindered last year, especially out on the perimeter, but even down low in rotation, stuff like that. The real question for me with Kristaps Porzingis is how is he going to be an offensive threat? Because I don't think the jump shot is really so valuable that it's a bankable skill that will buoy his offensive value. And if the jump shot's not going to buoy offensive value, he's got to find other ways to score. He's not really a role threat, and he's not really a post-up guy at all. So where those other avenues come from, he's not really even like a high-level facilitator of offense for others. So the theory of KP on offense is that the floor spacing allows you to put a guy who's a little bit more dynamic at the nominal four. And in the past, that's been Dwight Powell. I think I still have, for the majority, I guess, the same questions about Kristaps Porzingis as I had, you know, even 2 or 3 years ago. But being healthy will make a big difference in his ability to reach those higher level outcomes, I think.
And we did see some moments, even in the playoffs, where like he just decided to splash from like 28 feet. And that's probably the Kristaps skill on offense, not just the shooting, but like he can look like nobody else when he's dialing from like a few feet behind the 3-point line. I think that's definitely something unique to him. Like I said, I kind of avoid talking about him in general, just because of all his off-court stuff that we don't need to like overly get into. But if you feel like I'm glossing around Kristaps Porzingis, it just makes me feel icky to talk about him. Of course, that's a whole nother podcast. Next up is at Dumb Ethan Tweets. What are some small off-season moves you feel like will have a big impact? Also, where do y'all stand on candy corn? Let's stick with the Mavs. Why not? Now, I understand if you guys have forgotten this. Reggie Bullock is on the Mavs. Did you know that?
Have you seen this? Have you heard of this? Yeah, I thought that was a pretty interesting signing. We talked about that in one of our group chats when it first happened. And I think I'm not quite as high on the Reggie Bullock signing as some may be, just because I do think shooting is valuable for that team. But what Dallas really needed, in my opinion, was another guy who could ball handle. And I don't think they really got that guy. So I don't want to, you know, gloss over Reggie Bullock just because he isn't what I thought the Mavs needed, because he's a very good player and will be super useful for them, I think. But I don't think that they fixed all of their issues this offseason like they would have liked to, maybe.
I will say I think he might be – it's either – okay, it's Luka, then it's Tim Hardaway, and then third best, like, closeout attacker shoot dribble pass – offensive player is either him or Dorian Finney-Smith. I'd probably lean Reggie Bullock. One of the more confounding trades for me was when the Pistons traded him for Svi Mihailuk when they were, you know, gunning for the eighth seed. Bullock was kind of their second best player in some ways, maybe third behind Drummond. He continues plays with, you know, putting the ball on the floor. He really does. He's like the quintessential, like, role player, shoot, dribble, pass wing. And it's kind of confounding that he was not necessarily sought after for a couple of years. And he kind of proved why he should be in New York. And I think that I just, you know, I've always been a fan of his game going back to Detroit. So, yeah, I'll pick him as my, you know, just getting another guy who can put the ball on the floor. I think they missed that in Seth Curry, you know, obviously trading him for Josh Richardson, who doesn't reliably do that to the same degree. Yeah, Reggie Bullock.
I think my pick would be Cody Zeller. I think the Blazers signed Zeller for, boy, I want to say it was like the minimum or pretty close. And he's a guy who I think a lot of teams probably should have had interest in. He's pretty defensively versatile, solid rebounder, can score a little bit down low, can shoot a little bit of mid-range as well. He just does a little bit of everything, and he's just a solid player, especially at that price level for that team in specific, who needs, you know, bigs who can rotate in, who can, you know, not give up too much on either end and just fill minutes. And honestly, Zeller's going to do more than that. I think he's a starter level player, and they got him for basically nothing. So that's a really interesting signing that I think is going to pay dividends this year.
I'm going to go another direction and actually pick a player that's no longer on a team, and that's Jeff Green leaving the Brooklyn Nets. Now, I still think the Brooklyn Nets are my really early season favorites, especially if they're at full health. I just don't see any team really stopping them. But, you know, as the Bucks fan around here, watching Jeff Green shoot like 60% from three during that series in seven games, he does a lot as a five that I don't think you can really replicate with many players in the league. And obviously they can put multiple players like, you know, Blake Griffin, whoever else they have that can do that. But I don't think any of them could replicate Jeff Green. And having Jeff Green out there kind of sort of has somebody that's built like Kevin Durant, and it keeps Kevin Durant from having to play the nominal five. So I don't know how much it's going to impact them, but Jeff Green's always good to have a huge scoring explosion in the playoffs, and he's versatile and plays his role well. So I do think that's going to hurt the Nets a little bit more than it's been discussed.
I've developed a huge appreciation for those, you know, great shooters who like are a, you know, combo 4-5 type who can admirably defend at the 4 or 5 position. Obviously Jeff Green, you know, it helps to have an engaged Kevin Durant on defense, kind of cleaning up things on the back line. But that there's not that many guys who fit that description. It's Jeff Green, I'd say Bobby Portis, which was like a key ingredient, obviously, to Milwaukee's run, that he could like play with Lopez or without Lopez and, you know, space the floor and hold up, do okay, you know, defensively. Say what you will about how they were hunting him. They hunted anybody because they're Chris Paul and Devin Booker. Kelly Olynyk is that. Kelly Olynyk is a fantastic player. Jamichael Green. So Denver has two of these guys, and a guy who currently isn't in the NBA, Nikola Mirotic, who was a huge part of that run that the Pelicans made. And the Jazz were really, you know, courting him, but obviously he kind of surprised everybody by leaving the NBA. There are a few more, but like that, not that many more guys like that.
And the guys who do or are capable of fulfilling that role, a lot of times they aren't capable of fulfilling that role for a bunch of seasons in a row. It takes a kind of special mix of athleticism, strength, and just like court awareness and feel for the game, and that balance is tough to strike for very long. So a good example of a guy who I think probably used to be that and now is pretty much only a five is Paul Millsap. But yeah, that archetype is a lot of fun, and it gives you so much versatility in how you can construct your lineup. So I love it too. It's a great time.
Absolutely.
We have to do candy corn takes.
Oh yeah. So one thing I don't love, no, I actually don't hate candy corn. I will take a handful of it if I'm at a Halloween party and I just see it and I'm like, oh boy, candy corn. But then, you know, now in my older age, at a grizzled 27 years, I kind of see, I have a sugar quota for myself in such occasions. You know, I want to have X amount of candy, so I'm more likely to go for something with chocolate. So it's not that candy corn is bad. It's just that, you know, I don't feel bad passing it up for something else.
I think candy corn is fine. I have maybe like a small bag of candy corn. I don't know, like every other year. Candy corn itself is probably the second best of the Halloween candied, items, themed items. Candy pumpkins are better than candy corn, in my opinion.
Ooh.
A better bite that disperses better over the teeth. I don't know. It's just better to chew, in my opinion. Candy corn is like a weird shape. I don't know. Candy corn is fine.
Do they make Reese's pumpkins? Because
I think that's a thing.
All of the best Reese's peanut butter cups are not Reese's peanut butter cups. They're the Christmas tree and the egg and the heart. And so what better to capitalize on the candy holiday than make a Reese's pumpkin?
Yep, that exists. Reese's Franken cups, which are just Reese's peanut butter cups, but the bottom is green. Like the bottom half of the chocolate is green. That's a pretty wild. They do Reese's bats too, it appears.
Do you guys remember like green ketchup?
Yeah, yes, that stuff 100. Was horrifying. I've never eaten it because it grosses me out. Also, there was purple ketchup for a while.
Yeah, that
which
one
should
was
not
weird.
Exist.
That one was weird, but green ketchup, that was fun. You dip a fry in a green ketchup, and it's a different vibe. Not a better vibe, but a different vibe, which can sometimes be a better vibe.
That was a weird phase for a while where people were just releasing different colors of things. But for candy corn, I was actually talking to somebody about food takes in general, and they made the great point. They're like, when people say they don't like a food, there never seems to be a statement of like, I wish I didn't hate this food. It's almost like I hate this food because I am enlightened and understand the food better than you all. So I'm going to take that approach. I don't like candy corn. I will actively avoid eating it. But I wish I liked it. You know, why wouldn't I like to eat more food? If I could eat all of the food, that would be great. And anytime I don't like a food, it makes me very sad because I'm like, oh, look at this thing that other people enjoy, this taste profile that I'm not able to experience because for some reason I'm hardwired at the moment to not like it. So that's my call to action right now. Open your mind. And if you hate a food, ask yourself if you feel superior to other people because you hate that food, or if you've actually interrogated yourself to see why you hate that food and if you've actually given that food a fair shake.
Wow. Is he really one of your top three marks?
Get his ass, Cody. No.
I feel like I sub podcast every member of Premium Hoops at some point. So I apologize, Mark. I really didn't.
We're talking about you
there.
We're talking about you. Make no mistake.
But congratulations on the fame. That's pretty cool.
I always say it's good. He isolates his bad takes and he keeps his basketball content clean. So, you know, there's some good there's some, it's like the purge where crime is down because of that one thing. And the food takes are Mark's purge of the bad takes.
If you loved this podcast, ask Mark how he feels about green ketchup and do it on the timeline so I can see.
Yes, please. Please, at Premium Hoops account and Mark, thoughts on green ketchup. Thank you.
Speaking of Mark and food, though, lately on my YouTube suggested watch, I've been getting a bunch of videos that's like, eat 1,800 calories and have like 300 grams of protein, and I swear that it's Mark. Like, I don't think it's Mark, but I almost like took a screenshot and put it on the timeline and been like, is this Mark Schindler? I should actually probably just send it to him to make sure he's not living a double life of teaching me how to pack more protein into my calories.
Does Mark work for V-Shred?
We should have a really long laugh and you should leave it unedited. Just absolutely. Let it drag on for like 10 seconds.
Candy corn also is helped by the fact that it's called candy corn. It makes about 10% better in my book. Like, it takes something, you know, kind of everyday, you know, monotonous like corn. And it's like, whoa, you know, this is corn. It's candy corn. You know, it creates that association, which it's the equivalent of riding a skateboard down a school hallway versus a sidewalk. You know, it just makes it cooler.
We've been on the candy corn topic for so long now that my brain is trying to think about candy popcorn, like popping candy corn. Ooh, and seeing what happens. It would just melt. It's not going to work. It would just melt.
At Lucas_Kaplan says, what one-to-one trade, if any, would be a win-win for the teams involved? When I think of a one-for-one trade that's perfect, I think of Seth Curry for Josh Richardson, which happened last offseason. So, you know, Mavericks really got better at the point of attack and they didn't need Seth Curry anyway. So I will propose that idea for my Boston Celtics. I think that Seth Curry would be a fantastic dent maker in our offense because you have to double team him. And I just love the idea of Josh Richardson on the Philadelphia 76ers. I just think that would work perfectly. So please, please trade Josh Richardson off my favorite team and give me Seth Curry. Anyone?
Sorry, I had chat open. So when I held spacebar to unmute, it just typed a bunch of spaces into the chat box. I'm bad at trade machine. And at this point in the offseason, most of the players who were going to be traded have been traded, except for like Ben Simmons and Pascal Siakam. If Pascal even gets traded, which like I haven't heard anything on that in over a month probably. So honestly, I'd lean towards a one-for-one trade involving Thad Young because I know he's almost definitely still available and could help a contender. And whoever the Spurs get in return will probably better fit their timeline, even if it's just a pick or a pick and like salary filler or something like that. So that's my nomination. We kind of went into the Thad Young destinations earlier. Sorry for the boring kind of repeat answer, but it's tough to think of who might be traded when we're kind of in the midst of the end of the offseason, really, and a lot of the roster moves have already happened.
So here's one that I proposed like this time last year, and maybe it still makes sense, even though it doesn't fit the Spurs timeline, but might help with their departure of DeMar DeRozan. Thad Young for Will Barton.
So the only thing is they can't trade Will Barton until December, right? Because I think he just re-signed.
Yep,
in Denver.
He did. But I don't know.
It's interesting.
He's. It makes more sense every year the more Michael Porter Jr. gets good at this basketball thing.
Is Thad Young's passing game kind of nullified next to Jokic, though? Like, are you actually getting the best Thaddeus Young that you could be in that
yes.
lineup?
Because your alternative is Aaron Gordon.
I think it's, I do think it gets nullified a little bit. And that's what kind of why I think Chicago was okay trading him, because we saw once Chicago acquired Nikola Vucevic that they both kind of like to occupy the same spaces. And while they were compatible, I think on the defensive end, on the offensive end, it diminished Thad's shine a little bit. And I think he does best when he's the guy down low, distributing, hitting those little push shots and little floaters. And you know, just like covering lots of different roles on the defensive end. Maybe he loses a little shine next to Jokic, but you probably wouldn't start him anyways. He'd be like the first big off the bench. And you could kind of, well, I guess it depends whether you consider MPJ a big, but I don't really. So, it'd be an interesting fit and probably a reasonably fair trade as well.
Speaking of MPJ, what if, and the salaries don't work, what if you did MPJ for Ben Simmons straight up?
Oh, I would not do that as Denver.
I don't think I would. Oh, that's tough. I think Ben is a better player, but, and I think, oh man, that's really difficult. I don't know if it actually makes the Sixers that much better either. Like, I think he's a slightly better fit, but I don't think he's as good as Ben, so I think it still limits their ceiling a little bit. But that's interesting. Honestly, that's probably the best one that's been proposed, because I think I'm not sure which side would say no. Which
firmly, is usually I'm firmly MPJ. I'd rather have him than Ben. And I'm not even one of those like garbage spewers about Ben Simmons. I think he's a top 30-ish player in the league. I just also think that MPJ will be that very soon, if not already.
What about Kyrie Irving for Ben Simmons straight up?
Oh, Kyrie's much better than both of these, all these guys.
But with the amount of scoring that the Nets already have, would it actually help to be able to have Ben Simmons there and do the nominal five position that Jeff Green would have taken? And I know he's not the shooter that Jeff Green is, but he could take that sort of space while you already have Harden and Durant for offense.
I don't think I'd want to play Ben at the five very much, to be honest. I think you get the most out of him if you can deploy him on the perimeter. And maybe if Brooklyn really likes to switch stuff within that lineup, then that would be a lot of fun. I think it does. He does probably balance their roster out better. Like, Brooklyn has three just insane on-ball creators. How much do they lose if they drop one of them and replace him with an all-NBA level defender? I'm not sure. And like, Ben Simmons can do stuff on ball too. The shooting around him would be insane. So that's kind of interesting. I don't think either team would do it. But it does make both teams better.
I just think that it's so helpful to have like infinite creation options that fold in on each other, and up there's another creation option. And oh, what's that over there? Another advantage of creation. I think that is the most important thing for an NBA team right now, is just having counters to your counters to your counters on offense. So I almost don't look at it as an embarrassment of riches. I mean, I definitely do, but I do see avenues in which it's necessary when you talk about the best of the best to have Kyrie there. And you know, it almost seems like, oh, let's just be worse at offense because we can be, and I guess we'll be a little better at defense. I'm still team Kyrie in that regard. You'd have to like go down to that, back to that MPJ rung for me to look at a Ben Simmons trade and be like, yeah, that helps both teams. So the next one is at AARON25. Favorite / most ideal destination if Cam Reddish were to be traded this season? I mean, a lot of people for the beginning part, especially any young team that needs wing defense and creation upside. If, you know, mostly defense, but you know, Reddish is still interesting on offense too. Did you guys have any like overwhelming teams?
Nothing overwhelming, but I was just kind of having the thought that getting a second lease on life in Detroit might be kind of cool.
Oh my gosh, I love that.
Yeah, I think I think they still need to build out the wings a little bit with some interesting guys who can do a little bit of everything, and it would give Cam Reddish a kind of clean slate to develop in a great number of directions, really, kind of depending on what they think is the best fit for him. So That might be a little bit interesting. Otherwise, he just needs somewhere where he can play more often.
Yeah, don't trade Cam Reddish. That's my take. Keep him on the Hawks. I like him there.
Yeah, you know, the more you do this, the more you realize that like 6'9" players who are in control of their own body and understand where to be on defense are pretty rare. Next one is from at Oscar NBA. What 2021 season success story do you think teams will overcorrect for in the 2022 draft? Example, Davion going lottery and smaller in response to smaller primaries having playoff success last year. I guess that is a correlation. I saw Davion as more of like a Fred VanVleet type, which I don't consider a primary, but you know, the point is made, you know, the point is taken rather. This is one is so hard for me because you have to predict what will be work next year, who will be, you know, breakout, who will exceed expectations, and then be what the specific reaction will be to that, you know, changing of, you know, what we expected. So I don't really have an answer for this one, unfortunately.
Are we going to go and try and find the next Giannis? Is that a possibility? Like, are people just going to draft every 6'9", 6'10"? Player and be like, this is the next Giannis, kind of like how Draymond Green, everyone was the next Draymond Green and everyone was the next Anthony Davis for those couple of years.
And that's kind of already happened with Chris Middleton. Like every kind of shoot, like player who can shoot and dribble and is 6'8", is basically the, you know, Chris Middleton comp. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer will be. This is from at Oren Brooklyn. Sense and switchability. Does Mobley with his fluidity, playmaking, and help D, is that a reliable option at the three for the Cavs to play alongside Allen and Markkanen? Majority of b-ball people see big initiator as best foundation for team building. What is the second most important piece? So I guess, yeah, we're asking, can Mobley play the three, first of all?
No, I don't think that's a good idea.
Yeah, why did they sign Lauri Markkanen to that?
I hope it's not to play the three, because he played the three in Chicago last year, and I don't think it was really a good fit. Now, I will say there the theory behind it kind of makes sense, because if he's not really going to defend fours or fives super well anyways, you might as well stick him on the wing, because he kind of plays like a wing, and you can get some still good advantage out of that quick release, that high release, in a near 7 foot or legit 7 foot player who shoots over 40% from three. So I kind of get it, but I think you would most want to play like two of these bigs together. Probably start Allen and Mobley with Markkanen off the bench, because Markkanen can mix in with either one. So you can kind of stagger based off what makes sense there. I would not play any of them at the three personally, just because they lack the mobility to defend out on the perimeter. I think Mobley can do it, but you really don't want him out on the perimeter full time like that, or most of the time like that, because it takes away a lot of the what makes him special, which is the ability to contest shots down low.
Yeah, I kind of see Lowry, if this all works out, as like this, you know, like I talked about, kind of this different version of this Bobby Portis slash, you know, Kelly Olynyk slash four slash five, who makes up for, you know, it with his shooting. And I don't know if the defense can be where it is for those guys, but I think that's the hope here, right? Yeah. So that's, and then what's the second most important piece? I think what we're talking about with Evan Mobley is, for me, you know, just a guy who unlocks all different types of schemes, whether it's a four or a five. And I guess in Mobley's case, it's both. You know, it's kind of the defensive version of that wing initiator who unlocks pretty much any offensive style you want to play, where all of a sudden you can incubate lesser defenders. You can, you know, play Lowry at the five and then have Evan Mobley as the weak side rim protector. It is just kind of the defensive analog to that wing initiator.
Personally, I feel like the second best or second most valuable is just another primary creator who can shift down to being a secondary creator. And like you were talking about with the offense folding in itself with Harden, Durant, and Kyrie being on the same team, once you have that, you can kind of just throw anyone else to fill in that roster, a la what the Nets are doing with just signing people. And anyone that they sign, people are freaking out like, oh, this is unfair. But like, it wouldn't be unfair if they signed with anyone else. It's just unfair because they already have the ecosystem to pretty much just fit any of the other skills that aren't recognized as all NBA slash all-star type skills. So I say the more creators you can get, the better. But then, like you said, if that's not available, somebody that's an outlier in some of those tertiary type skills, like a Draymond or a potential Mobley is the other
Robert person. Covington.
There, Robert I said Covington.
It. I said it on the podcast. This one is from Schwag One. Halliburton, Fox, or Simmons long term? That's a toughie for me. For me, it's probably between Fox and Simmons. And if I didn't make my biases clear, I might lean Fox, just because. But that's still really tough, because I PD Webb had a tweet where it was like, if Simmons was on the Kings, he'd be their best player in the last 10 years. And that's absolutely true. But I just have, I'm a sucker for De'Aaron Fox. I don't know.
Yeah, I think I'd take Simmons over Fox and Fox over Halley. I don't think Halliburton is in this conversation yet. I do think he's a lot of fun, but the other two guys are like all-star level or borderline all-star level players. The difference between Simmons and Fox, I think Fox is a better initiator and creator of offense, and Simmons is a better defender. It kind of depends what you need, which is a little bit of a cop-out answer. But if I was going to start a team with either guy and with nothing else on the books, with nobody else on the books, I think I'd pick Simmons first, just because he can do a little bit of creation, but he's also just an absolutely elite defender. He can do more than a little bit of creation, especially if it's a system built around him. Whereas with Fox, he's a little bit more of a, common archetype, I guess, in the sense that he's a guard-sized creator. He's a good defender, but I wouldn't say he's an elite defender. And the creation, especially the rim pressure, is really, really good, but I think there are still some questions about the shot. And yeah, of course, it's better than Ben Simmons' shot, but I don't know if it's so much better that the size difference and the defense difference gets washed out.
And people will point to like Simmons' playoff struggles. I've said this about Fox, even though I really like him. He is one of those players who has benefited from never being in a playoff series. We don't know exactly what teams will do to Fox in the pick and roll when they don't have to respect the shot, which they don't really have to. He doesn't have much of a pull-up mid-range game because he doesn't like shooting moving forward. He much rather opts for a floater, or which he isn't as good at, as like a Trae Young type, because no one is. Or like, you know, finishing through contact, and people are going to pack the paint if he's not as scary from elsewhere. So the logical flow of De'Aaron Fox's game hasn't quite like been exposed in a way it would be in a playoff series.
You two have really touched on Fox and Simmons in a great way, so I'm going to leave that alone. But for Halliburton, I really like Halliburton, like you said, but I think there's kind of two tracks that he might be going if he's actualized what we think he might be. Number one, he might be like a top tier elite level role player that's a switchblade, fits into any kind of roster, and is a really important piece on a championship team. But if he doesn't end up on that championship team, he might just end up being a miscast player who doesn't really meet his potential, because I don't know how much he's able to shift up to like a first primary creator sort of player. I think he's better off being that tertiary, secondary type creator on a high level team. I think he's very, I guess, scalable in this case, but I don't think he's very shiftable.
And then the last question, I'll sit this one out because I haven't seen any movies. I just play video games and watch basketball. At Dan Olinger, is it Olinger? Is it GIF or GIF?
Olinger,
it's a GIF. What is the better movie franchise, Marvel Cinematic Universe or Star Wars?
So I think overall, for talking like impact, Star Wars right now still has to be at the top just because it inspired so much that came after it. So if we're thinking in those sorts of terms, I don't think you can take over how important the original three Star Wars movies were for setting the culture when it comes to sci-fi and epic adventure type things. But as we go forward, there's a chance that the MCU overtakes that. I mean, superhero movies have completely dominated the culture that sci-fi movies didn't do in the 70s and 80s for the last decade or so. And it is showing no signs of slowing down. In fact, with like the new Spider-Man movie coming down, it's actually showing like it's speeding up. So superhero movies are literally just the culture. So there's a chance that that just overtakes the impact. But when we're talking about the actual movies, I think the Marvel Cinematic Universe is better. Like, maybe I'm just clouded by The Rise of Skywalker coming out, and I thought that was a terrible movie, and I thought they landed that trilogy in a really sad way that felt like a slap in the face to a fan, whereas, like, Infinity War and Endgame really landed the ship in a way better than I expected a huge franchise to do. So that's my overall answer. Right now, it's probably the MCU, but if we're looking at overall impact, it is still more than likely Star Wars.
I think I'm basically in the same spot with both of these franchises, in that I think they're mostly pretty mid in terms of their writing and their plot, but they're spectacles that are just tons of fun to watch. I think I probably enjoyed the Marvel Cinematic Universe characters more, because I was always more of a comic book guy than a Star Wars or sci-fi guy, except for Dune, which was an awesome book series, and I'm extremely excited for that movie. But I think if you made me pick one, I'd probably pick Marvel, but there's also some recency bias there. I haven't seen a Star Wars movie since, I guess, what would you call it, like the first six, the prequels and the original three. I haven't seen any of the new movies, so if those are significantly better than, you know, the higher heights of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, then perhaps that would swing my vote, but I think I'd probably have to give the edge to Marvel.
I have a question. I haven't seen many of the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, and like none of the Star Wars movies. Are the Tobey Maguire Spider-Mans part of the MCU?
No, I don't think so. I think because they rebooted him, they don't really count. But they should count because those are so fun. The first two, especially.
So good.
The emo Spider-Man like walk sequence out of his apartment or whatever, or like when he tells his landlord to fix the door and he gets all mean and tough about it. Those are memorable.
Oh my gosh. And that's like the worst of the three movies, but I like how I love Spider-Man 2. I love the high school fight scene in Spider-Man 1. I like how they end Spider-Man 2, the credits, with Vindicated by the Dashboard Confessional. This is why.
That's a good song. God, I didn't remember
Vindicated!
That.
Have you seen, it's Max Rappaport, who's like a Philly guy. When they got this pick that became Simmons, he made like a montage of like Sam Hinkie to that song.
I did not, but that is really funny.
Yeah, look, I'll send that to you when we're done. But yeah, it's just like Sam Hinkie grinning, and it's like, Vindicated, I am selfish, I am wrong, I am righteous. Okay, yeah, good song. I was listening to Taking Back Sunday today.
Also a great band. It's like, these are middle school throwbacks for me.
I know exactly what goes on.
And that's your pop punk quota for the day, everybody. Thanks for
I'm speechless. I'm flabbergasted. I'm done.
Cool. All right. Yeah. Finish. As our guy Mark Schindler says, have a good rest of your day, fools.